This podcast is brought to you by Data AI. Now, you're asking, didn't they get acquired by Sensor Tower? They did, and that's awesome. Here's why. Whether you loved using data.ai or Sensor Tower, the combined company will offer customers even stronger and more detailed insights on the full digital customer journey. Exciting times lie ahead as Sensor Tower and Data AI join forces. Go to data.ai or sensortower.com and get on board with undeniably the best data partner in the business. Now, back to the episode.
Wow. Welcome, everyone, to a special edition of Cress's Corner with Mr. Matt Weibel from Second Dinner. I haven't done this one, these type of things, in a while, but we recorded one last year that the internet gremlins took over. Obviously, most likely user error, but I'm calling it the internet gremlins. I wanted to bring Matt back and talk about what's going on at Second Dinner. You know, the good, the bad about Marvel Snap. What's next for the studio? And most importantly, what the hell do you do with a $100 million check in the bank? Like, what does that even look like from a company perspective? I've known Matt for quite a while, but we've actually met in person once. And the only thing I'm really holding against him is that he's one of those McKinsey consultants that I despise at times, but I'll admit he's one of the good ones. He actually has a passion for video games, unlike many of the others. And he abandoned the Tower of Babel at McKinsey long ago to pursue more noble activities, which basically means making video games. So to start, Mr. Weibel, let's talk about your career. What have you done? Where have you come from? What keeps you going? What's up?
It's all been leading up to this, Cress, first of all. So this is all, I don't know if I'm going to be able to stay motivated post. This is the pinnacle of, you know, just everything's been leading this moment. I'm extreme, you know, dream come true. Very excited. So I've made it finally.
If the pinnacle of your career is talking to me, okay, we have problems. Maybe this is not going to be that interesting.
This is great. But, I mean, it's like you guys, y'all, you guys are fun. You guys are celebrities. Very nice of you to spend a little time talking to me. Background. I've always loved video games. I grew up in a rural area, kind of the upper Midwest, in Michigan. And I played video games like constantly, nonstop, in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s and stuff. And then when dial-up came, and dial-up internet came, it like freaking blew my mind, like tons of Quake 2, lots of Diablo 2. And then like I got like super, super, super deep in a game called EverQuest, which I played like 20,000 hours of EQ. So I basically, all I did was play video games and do distance running. So I studied economics in college. I worked at all the places you hate, like, you know, finance, like Goldman Sachs, McKinsey, blah, blah, blah. Then I had a few different adventures. So I worked at an early video streaming startup that's actually still around, which is pretty cool. It's like almost 20 years ago now. And then I spent a summer running from the Atlantic to the Pacific Ocean with my friend, just on foot, pushed a jogging stroller. Then I spent a couple of years at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs, Colorado, on a national team for an Olympic sport that no one's ever heard of that's about to get cut after the next games. So I retired after the London Olympics from that. After that, I decided to kind of get serious. I did a grad school. I did a JD MBA at Harvard. And while I was there, I always loved video games. And I was like, I want to just like try this out for the summer. And I got super lucky. I got hired at Blizzard Entertainment working on what was called the Strategic Initiatives team, which was basically like the original OG like product and strategy team for Blizzard, working for Mike Morhaime, the founder. And so it was a team of like longtime industry vets with that kind of also had some business background, like came out of, the guy running the team, who's still my boss today, was the EP on Halo. And so there's like this longtime industry vets and me, and they're nice enough to take me on. We did like all different kinds of stuff for Blizzard. So one of my first big projects was I pitched what became World of Warcraft token system. I did all the design for how it works, developed like kind of like a trading platform behind the scenes for like valuation, how it would move, all those sorts of things. We worked on like the early what became Overwatch, like that design and that pivot, how that business would work, might work. Then one of our big focuses was this thing. We had a team that we led making a game called Hearthstone. So digital card game, initially kind of spinning out of World of Warcraft trading card game and evolving from there. So helped build that team, the game from scratch, and they shipped it with like 15 people, which was awesome. It was kind of a skunkworks project for the company, trying to make something like live service, a multi-platform, free to play, but you know, like with a smaller team. And it took off. It did really well. We ended up just really focusing on that and driving that business for a few years. I was like a crazy Hearthstone addict. So I had more games played of Hearthstone than anyone that worked at Blizzard. A bunch of like top 100 legend season finishes. I was like, just like, I had like 60,000 games played of Hearthstone. So a lot. Then after that, I spent a couple years leading the Overwatch business. And around that time, I rejoined some of my friends and colleagues that worked at Blizzard, a new company. So Second Dinner. So here I was the original general manager on Snap, and I'm the company's chief operating officer. So I'm responsible for like the commercial operation of the company, as well as our live games. Yeah.
All right. Well, that is quite the background. The only thing that actually I didn't know was that, first of all, that you have a JD MBA, which is pretty crazy. But then I don't know. I didn't know that you actually worked on the WoW token system, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, from day one.
Yeah. So really the point of talking to you right now, and the only thing, the real value proposition, or the value there, or the thing that we talk about more on the podcast, is about Marvel Snap. And like being one of the most successful games launched in the last few years certainly hit my mice nuts threshold of 100 million life to date. So that's good. According to Data AI, it has about 22 million downloads and $140 million in revenue. Obviously, there's a lot of off-platform stuff going on and PC stuff that's not accounted for. But let's assume it does around 100 million or so a year, per se. Something like that. Anyway. But one of the criticisms that like we had at launch, and I think we continue to have, is like how non-aggressive they were from a monetization perspective. Like, I think you're going to argue less likely that you focus more on gameplay than broader systems, but it was pretty evident early, and also like based upon the RPI that's in Data AI, is that it's relatively low to some of the comps. So I guess, how would you respond to that characterization that we made on the podcast? And also like, how would you just characterize the Snap launch in general, from your perspective, good and bad?
Yeah. On the monetization side, I think we're not afraid of, you know, if we can make awesome stuff that our players want to buy, selling them that stuff. That's like, you know, every once in a while, like I hear, someone sort of intimate, like maybe we weren't, that we were like worried about that or something. Definitely not. I think overall we're happy with the kind of progress we've made there. You know, I think you already mentioned in terms of like specific numbers, you know, there's a lot of, I always tell people, especially if games are multi-platform, you know, we're on PC, we got a big, pretty substantial web shop. Like, you got to take any specific numbers with a grain of salt, but just in general, we're happy with the kind of growth that we've seen. You know, I think there's a way to think about this, which is like just in terms of monetization, I think it's a little bit bigger than just monetization. I'll tell you what our big learnings, I'll just go through like kind of our learnings overall. I think there's some stuff about the launch and overall what we did was really great. That kind of proved out our theses for like what we wanted the company to be and what kind of games we want to make. I think there's still, you know, there's room for novel gameplay, polished experiences with really top IP. You know, we can make something, you know, with a new team without a bunch of crunch or something crazy like that. We can, you know, make games and the way that we make them, which tends to be like kind of longer pre-pro stage with really small teams, kind of finding the fun, iterating super fast, you know, kind of believing truth is in the build, all that kind of stuff. And then like get really disciplined on that before scaling. It's kind of like our general development framework, right? And so like all those pieces, you know, we have very highly integrated teams. I like to say we don't have people that work, we don't really have people that work on the game. We have people that work in the game. So like really, really integrated, you know, kind of working together, not some like far off team telling a development team what to do or something like that. Everyone working together to make the business better, make the game better. You know, I think there's still lots of room for organic reach for the right kind of game. I think that's still something we're benefiting from in a bunch of ways. And we can make some fully remote. So like all that stuff is really good. So like just, I think we learned a lot even from the launch, from the first year plus now of operating. You know, I think a lot of those pieces were valid. I think to your point, you know, there's a few things. One is the market's a lot less forgiving, I think, than it was a few years ago. The like margin for error is like much lower. And I think in particular, you know, 5-6 years ago, you could make a game that was awesome in some way, but had like a big hole in it, in you know, like had amazing moment to moment, but like the live ops were really thin for like a long period of time, and it could still be really successful. I think now it's gotten really hard to, I contend, maybe not even like possible to really successfully operate that way. You just have to be pretty strong everywhere. Like this, that's just like what's happened in the market. And then you're asking about monetization. I think it's even broader than that. I think it's like live ops progression, like those sort of ongoing content delivery systems, those longer term loops of, you know, multi-week, month, year kind of stuff. I think there we've learned a lot. I would, you know, this maybe is kind of like hand wavy, but I think of game development, like at the extreme, you can make games either inside out or outside in. So inside out is like very moment to moment heavy. Like what, okay, let's like polish this like exact thing players are going to really be spending most of their time doing. And then we'll worry about like kind of meta systems and progression and, you know, maybe like monetization and that like longer term content delivery, like kind of like that's like a second priority, right? Or it's like kind of further down the chain versus, you know, outside in development, which I think you see games that like are extremely strong in terms of like meta progression, that content delivery, their social systems, whatever it is, they're really architected for that long-term live operation, even if the game in the mid, like the inside is like not as much of a focus, right? You can make great games both ways. Like I think a lot of really successful games lately have been outside in, like I would describe like Monopoly Go that way or Went Out Survival, or, you know, there's a bunch of games. I think they can make awesome games that way. We've tended to be much more inside out, right? Like Snap is like really awesome moment to moment. Moving the cards around feels good. And the mechanics are really fun and dynamic. If we could go in a time machine, we would definitely have given more time and resources to our team earlier to build out the outside, right? That meta wrapper, that like kind of monetization layer. And I think now to be at like, to have a scaled launch, you really need like all those things in place at like day one to de-risk what you're doing and like just to be able to execute at a really high level. And, you know, frankly, it's probably too much like building the plane mid-flight that we were doing post launch. I think we got a lot of those systems in place in a pretty good way in terms of our kind of long tail monetization and progression systems. We were able to hit a lot of the marks, but I think we would have been better served, frankly, if we'd been, I think, still inside out, if you will, like really focus on that tight, novel, like polished, awesome gameplay in the middle, but more quickly and with more conviction, like making sure we have this wrapper and those kind of like systems and like, you know, the really robust shop and those pieces, like, you know, in place. It's a little tough though, because like obviously everything's a trade-off, and, you know, that's the question, right? How do you make something awesome in the middle that still hits all the marks and is really, really resonant in all those ways, but also without like taking away, you know, like from this other side.
I wanted to talk to you about Heroic Labs. building a successful game is hard enough without worrying about building your own game tech as well. Heroic Labs provides a comprehensive game stack to help you get your game into market faster and scale beyond the competition. With their Unity game framework Hero, you can cut development and prototyping time in half and quickly add social, economy, and reward systems to grow your game. Satori, the LiveOps platform built specifically for the games industry, lets you run live events, A/B tests, deliver dynamic content to players, and always keep your game growing. Nakama, the industry's leading open source game server, lets you develop locally, providing all social and competitive features for your game, and then seamlessly transition to their Heroic Cloud hosted service and easily scale to meet the largest of audience demands. Find out how to get started at heroiclabs.com.
Hey game devs, are you tired of dealing with complicated payment processes all over the world? Well, Xola's got your back with Xola PayStation. It has a simple, user-friendly interface that makes it easy for players to pay for your games and in-game content however they want. And because the Xola PayStation user interface is adaptive and accessible on smartphones, tablets, and PCs, your players will have a seamless experience no matter their preferred device. Players can save their favorite payment methods for future purchases, and on mobile, even charge purchases directly to their phone carrier bill. On the back end, you can customize your checkout with game-specific integration options like sidebars and iframes, as well as change colors, fonts, and images to make PayStation look and feel like a natural part of your game. Ready to see Xola's PayStation in action? Visit xola.pro/payments-dof or visit the link in this podcast description.
Yeah, and the other aspect of this that it was we talked about on the podcast, and also there was some coverage about, was the marketing efforts around the game. With Newverse, and you know, rest in peace. But so I guess there's two questions I have. Do you think that there are things that Newverse did that were not effective, or that, or they should have dedicated resources differently in order to help market the game? And then second, in retrospect, would this be something, actually not retrospect, because you probably would have done the same thing. For the next game, are you planning on doing it yourself? Are you going to publish yourself, or are you going to try to find another publisher?
Sure. Yeah. So I guess the first question first, we do things differently. I mean, in some ways, yeah, I think obviously, right. One thing that we would definitely do differently, I think that doesn't get talked about as much, is we would have gone heavier into influencer.
Right.
From the jump.
You guys had good influencer coverage though, didn't you?
Like, we did, but we could have had even more, especially outside of English.
Okay.
Like, so outside, there's international.
Hold on. Those IGN guys could not stop talking about this effing game. It was crazy, dude. They just would not stop. And they're not really, I mean, they're influencers in our world, but maybe more broader influencers that
I think there's just more room to, I think, especially for kind of more mid-core games. I think that if you get it right, it's really cost effective. It's a little tricky because, of course, it's like harder to tie back, right? It's just harder to tie back one-to-one, and you can spend a lot of money in an effective way. But
those guys don't give a shit about performance. They just care, you know, you give them money and they promote it, right? Like it's
it's not as tight as like direct performance marketing, like spend a dollar, you got 90 cents back, or $1.20 or whatever, right? So there's like some stuff to work through there. But in general, I think that's really powerful. I wish we probably would have done even more. And you know, Newverse was a great partner. We were working hand in hand with them the whole time. So it's not like, you know, it's definitely like all of us kind of learning together at the same time.
Well, that point is the one that I think we and you and me talked about this ages ago, is that like, yeah, Newverse was a new publisher, right? So like learning together on a project, it's just not... Doesn't seem like the smartest move.
We had a lot of industry veterans on, you know, working on this. But yeah, we were definitely working together, both of us kind of doing things that were new to us in these roles, right? In terms of, you know, kind of the future, we'll see. To be honest, and you know, this is the first game for me ever, and for a lot of us at the company, where we haven't owned our own go-to-market, but we just had we felt like Newverse, and they've been a great partner. We were able to work really closely with them and do a lot of things that we wouldn't be able to do on our own, right? This is a small company. So if you ask me, like, in general, we're pretty comfortable building out our own infrastructure. And, you know, it's kind of wait and see. We'll see what makes the most sense when we get there.
All right. So moving on. So what's the next thing? Like, what's this next project? You have 100 million dollars. $100 million. That's a lot of money, right? Particularly for a mobile game, assuming you're making a mobile or maybe a cross-platform game. I don't know. Can you give us any hints? And again, are you publishing yourself? What are the key learnings? Like, what's happening? Like, give us as much as you can give us.
Yeah, I mean, we're pleased to announce we're going to unveil right here on the podcast. Can we roll the trailer? Is that okay? No, maybe not. Okay. Yeah, we've been working on a couple of things for a while. I think they're already pretty legitimately fun, super fun to play, which is awesome. We're still early days, to some degree there, continuing to refine those, pressure test them, kind of follow that, the model I was talking about a little bit. One of them is a brand new IP that we're really excited about building. In my experience, building a new IP is the hardest thing to do in games. But, we think we're building something pretty special, and that's really, really exciting to us. And, I'm going to, in general, like, it's kind of the same blueprint that I think we just generally use when we think about any opportunity. It's the same thing here, which is we want to find a space where there's a game that we personally love and kind of deeply understand as players, which could be a lot of kinds of things, but that we deeply understand, that has like real demonstrated demand, that has real traction, but is not like a super dominant gorilla, like operating at some huge live service scale, right? And then like the model is, we take that, we try to make a live service version, super polished, has a best in class IP attached, really sort of very simple and sort of elegant, easy to learn. And works great in a platform native way, right? So usually, like a mobile, right? I think that's kind of the most exciting one to start with. And then extending into multi-platform when it makes sense. So that is a perhaps not as exciting answer as just unveiling everything we're working on today, but that's what I got for you.
All right. So let me be clear here. You're working on your own IP, a new IP, not a license, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, so well, we're working on a couple things. One of them is a new IP game.
Okay. You can't tell us the genre. Is it more core? Is it more casual? Like, is it similar?
Overall, I like us to not get like too hung up on that, because it's more about what's the opportunity, right? Is there a more core opportunity in this space, or is there more casual? Like,
got it.
Whatever side is there, as long as we're validating the side, the scale of the opportunity and all those sorts of things.
But actually, the big question for me, but based on your experience, do you think you guys are going to build out a publishing org? I mean, you have $100 million, so like you could actually
self-publish. It's quite likely that we will. I think we're very open to that. It's a lot, I'm not trying to minimize that. That's hard to do. That's a huge undertaking, but it's also something we have experience operating our own publishing previously, so it's not like a totally foreign concept to us or anything like that.
Okay. I have to come out and just say this quickly. $100 million. Like, really? Really? $100 million. I know you're a finance-oriented guy, right? Does this make sense to you? I've been talking about this on the podcast, right? Does this make sense from a VC investment perspective? Like, how do you get to a 10x, 40x, 50x, 60x, 100x type return? Again, this feels like more like a public equity investment as opposed to a VC,
Yeah, I mean, look, I've certainly heard the pod a few times here on this. Obviously, I think it's the right call, and I'm super glad we're at.
Hold on. By the way, of course you're happy with it, right? You're getting $100 million. Like, there's no reason. I'm just talking from the other perspective.
I get
from
it.
From the Griffin perspective. How does this make sense?
I get it. So, I mean, I think first of all, we have a vision for the company that continues to grow and to operate several best-in-class, amazing games that millions of players love that last forever, right? That's the goal. That's the dream. Snap is part of that dream. We think there's tons of growth inside of Snap that we want to be executing on over the next 12 to 24 months. Huge opportunity for this game in China. Tons of opportunity on PC. We have a clan system coming up and a bunch of, as you mentioned, like ongoing things like monetization improvements, continued live ops improvements. just a lot of room to run left on the title. And we have other projects that, you know, we're super excited about and they can do amazingly well. So, you know, we started talking about doing a Series B, thinking about what we should do next. We want to make sure, you know, in terms of what we were raising, that we had the capital we need to execute against the vision over the next couple of years here without being distracted by a bunch of rounds or capital crunch or any of those things. Really minimizing distractions to be able to execute at a high level and drive super dramatic growth, right? And the value of the company, we're able to deliver to players. So for that, you know, we're really, really fortunate. We went and talked to a bunch, you know, potential partners, right? Around the world, right? That vision and what we wanted to see the company become and the steps we wanted to take to get it and build it out and to turn this into a place that makes not just one, you know, hit game, but lots of hit games at a really successful, highly scaled level. We're really fortunate that resonated with a lot of the folks that we talked to. And out of all those conversations for us, as we're kind of thinking through, you know, the opportunities we had there in terms of fundraising, Griffin in particular really stood out because they understood where we were coming from really deeply. They'd done a ton of depth of background and research in the space and what we were thinking about. They had like really, really nuanced, deep questions. They'd done a ton of homework on the game and the team and all those pieces. So it was like we're grateful we had lots of opportunities. And in particular, like Griffin and Nettie's, who's been a great partner for us since we started, who also participated, just kind of being able to bring another partner in that's going to be really accretive to the quality of our thinking, to our strategy and our business has been great, right? So, I mean, look, that's the goal.
Look, like, I get it. You're building a company. You're not building products. Like, I think that's a huge differentiator, right? And you can stack on the different products and grow and scale and build your own IP and move over to other platforms. It's going to take a while, right? But just the sheer logistics of getting from a $400 million valuation, roughly, if you, you know, did a $100 million round, to a 10x return for a venture fund just seems extreme. Like a $4 billion valuation in the next 5 to 7 years or something like that. Like, I don't know, you know. But maybe this is a question for Griffin, right? So I'll punt it and try to get Griffin on here to explain how this is a VC type return, because it feels more like an equity return, right? Because I think I could put this kind of money into a VTI and make it over, you know, a 2 to 4x type return over the next like 5-7 years or something like that. Anyway, I think we should probably couch this, and so I'll talk to Nick. Anyway, is there anything else about Second Dinner that you want to cover before we move on? Because part of what I love talking with Matt about is industry stuff and his experience with other things. But what else is going on at Second Dinner?
You know, first of all, the DOF community has always been great to us and super grateful for them. We have a bunch of roles open. We're going to be opening some more in the coming months. Always excited to talk to top talent of any type, even if we don't have a role posted, hit me up. I'm on the Slack. I'm on LinkedIn, all those places. If you want to make a connection. I've been told that I have to give up my hermit ways, including by you, Eric, and start like going to conferences and doing things like this podcast, which is why I'm here. So
the games industry is experiencing unprecedented growth, with global revenues projected to reach a staggering $268 billion by 2025. But with more players than ever connecting across platforms and devices, how can your game stand out against the competition? AppsFlyer has created AppsFlyer for Games to help you unlock your players' true LTV by providing a wealth of game measurement solutions, unique industry insights, and proven best practices. Our dedicated hub is packed with innovative products, industry partnerships, and unrivaled expertise to ensure your game brand adapts and thrives. We understand that every game is unique, and AppsFlyer's data-driven insights allow us to cater to your specific needs. We know that in today's evolving landscape, staying ahead of the curve is crucial. Trust in AppsFlyer for Games to guide you through this exciting journey. We have the tools, the knowledge, and the passion to help you succeed in this ever-expanding landscape. Together, we'll conquer new worlds, both real and fantasy, break records, and create gaming experiences that leave a lasting impact. Get in touch with AppsFlyer for Games today and unleash your game's true potential. AppsFlyer for Games, supercharging the gaming landscape.
Hopefully I'll, you know, see some of y'all at DICE, at GDC, kind of some of those, you know, those things as well. So always, we were always eager to kind of talk to top talent, find the best people in the world that we can to come join our crew.
All right. So as I said, I always like to talk about Matt about the industry stuff because he's been in the business for quite a while. And even though he's a McKinsey consultant, we're not holding that against him. He still has great experience. So I guess, first of all, like in terms of the state of the industry and your experience with Blizzard, what's your thoughts on the current state of Blizzard and where they're headed? I don't know if you listened to the podcast, but I'm not really feeling good vibes about the future of Blizzard. What are your thoughts here?
Well, first, I'm just really saddened. My heart goes out to all my friends that were impacted by recent headcount reduction. It's just really hard on top of obviously a super hard time in the industry generally for like thousands of people. So that sucks. That's like the depth of my thoughts on that. My biggest hope is that the teams that are building and operating and marketing and kind of supporting the games get kind of clarity of vision and continuity. So I think it's just really hard to go through this time where there's a lot of things up in the air. Like, is an acquisition going to go through? Is it not? Is it, like those kind of pivots and that sort of movement is really, I think, hard for people to do their best work in, to make the best stuff, to operate at the highest possible level. So I think my hope more than anything else is that kind of some stability and some like kind of that clarity of North Star and being able to, kind of really focus and execute against that. I think there's a lot of, they have a lot of amazing games, right? World of Warcraft is still amazing.
They have amazing IP, yes. And amazing.
I played a ton of Diablo 4. I think they have, lots of room on the kind of live ops in particular area and kind of ongoing engagement to continue to level up. But the game's super fun. It's super fun to play.
All right. Basically, this is a really good point because this is just dovetailing exactly what you said before by developing inside out versus outside in, right? Clearly, Diablo is the game that was did Inside Out, just like your claim, right, about your game. So they did not spend a fucking minute. No, that's not true. They spent barely a minute of time thinking about the meta for Diablo. It's like I think the biggest disappointment. So and obviously it's the meta is pretty clear. It's just basically expansions and season pass type stuff, right? Which is, phoning it in type thing. So there's no real chase in the meta. So is it too late though? I mean, can they actually fix it? Or do they have the desire to fix it, you think?
I think there are thousands of people working there that want nothing more than to make the best games in the world for millions of players. In fact, I know that to be true. That's definitely true.
But they didn't do it, right? They didn't do it.
It's really hard to do both things, right? It's really hard to make the amazing thing in the center and all those systems at the same time. It's very hard to do. I think they still have time to do it. I think those franchises are quite durable. But yeah, I mean, anytime you're starting from something that where player counts are going down or what have you, turning the ship around is harder than, it's always harder to win back or to acquire more users than it is to retain, right? If you all else equal, right? So yeah, that's a tough spot to be in.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's hard. But they're super, especially, I think in particular now, post-IDFA, et cetera, having a durable franchise with tons of demonstrated affinity that players are going to give you a shot is incredibly valuable. The number of franchises that for which that is true are single digit, fewer than 20, right? It's probably, fewer than 20. And they have a few of them. That doesn't mean it's easy. That doesn't mean you don't need to learn new stuff. Obviously you do. But that's starting from that spot and then building a lot of the capabilities that you're highlighting and continuing to expand those. Not saying that's easy, but it's something you can execute on.
But unfortunately, we know, or I at least think I know anyway, is that this was a really conscious decision from a design perspective not to focus as much attention on the meta and monetization design within, you know, within in the middle of the seasons. This was an expansion pack season. This was a strategy. It was the wrong strategy, fundamentally, I think, anyway. But
I guess most of all, I'm super rooting for the teams and the games. And like, they can make amazing stuff. There's a ton of amazing leaders there. Like, I have a lot of confidence in the opportunity, right? The opportunity in front of them, I think, is really, really high. Being able to, you know, executing it is not going to be easy.
Yes, agreed. And I'm not even gonna try to get any information out of you on the leadership changes. But we'll move on. We'll move on because I promised I was gonna put you on the hot seat. All right. Okay.
It's a warm seat.
The one burning question that is in everyone's mind, or at least is in the minds of the A16Z guys, and their you know, crazy expectations on things, including AI. I guess, in your opinion, and try to be as actual practical and like giving me good examples of it, is like, how is AI, or how has AI helped the process of making games? And then also how you see AI as helping the process moving forward. And it will be will it actually be a cost savings for developers? I don't know. What's your experience with AI so far, and how do you see it moving forward?
Okay, I guess the question is this, like, AI question mark? Okay, so first of all, super enormous sea change, unequivocal. We're all into that. We've been very, I've been very skeptical of almost all trend chasing in the industry over the last, like, call it like post mobile, like last 6-7 years of like what was going to be the next like super huge thing. I've been extremely skeptical, like, the fundamentals of those things. We could pick on a bunch of them.
I mean, you're talking about VR streaming, AR, all that stuff.
Yeah.
That's what you're talking about.
I think a lot of e-sports. Like, you know, like, in certain ways, like some versions, like Web3 content, like, where there's a lot of open questions. There's just a lot of open questions and a lot of like, missing pieces in the chain in terms of how it would convert to being like a scalable business or.
Gotcha.
Or
anything like right. But AI, you feel differently.
AI is super different in this way, which is strange because I'm used to being like bearish. I've almost Cressian generally about the new things and being like, no, it's not going to work. Not going to work. Absolutely, totally different on AI. For us personally, you know, we started scaling up an AI focused team almost 2 years ago now. It's been really illuminating, and we've been able to do a lot of things already. I think that's a big distinction, like the amount of things we're able to do already that are really powerful is great. Now, like, first, also, like, caveat, like any other like disruptive sea change technology, whatever, we're all gonna be like somewhat wrong about how it works, and there's definitely danger of going too fast or too slow, and like it just is that's just how it is. In terms of like short to midterm, right? Because there's like the kind of hand wavy long term, which is interesting, but who knows? There's a ton of opportunities. I'm really excited about the ability to personalize players' game journeys and like the sort of responsiveness of content that you could have in using AI, right? Using like recommendation engines, using, which is sort of already proven technology, using LLMs, using all these pieces together to like generate content on the fly, to, you know, kind of really almost like handcraft an experience, if you will. So like, to me, like, one way to think about that, and I'll get into a specific in a second, because otherwise your eyes will glaze over, you'll just start saying BS over and over again, is like, how I think about this is, we went from not really testing live ops games to like A/B testing to like cohorted testing, right? Like creating more granular, like trying to like place people. Like, personalization, like recommendation engines are like the terminal point of that, right? They're like, Eric likes, we know, you know, we have 10,000 data points about Eric. We know he likes this kind of game. We can make sure his next game experience, he's match made with this kind of player or this kind of bot. He's going to see this thing, and we can really, like, you know, we can scalably, you know, sort of craft that for you in particular, right? That's really powerful, and that doesn't require like some technology to be invented that isn't invented yet, right? It requires.
No, but that's. But hold on, that's not AI though. That's.
I mean, that's recommendation just, engine power
algorithm.
Well, I mean, what's the? This is certainly a component of AI, right?
All right, fine. Machine learning is not AI. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not the AI we're looking for, right? All right, continue.
Fair enough. I mean, these are kind of all of a piece, though, right? Because another example of that is like custom, the endpoint on that personalization can also be like something custom made, right? Like it could be, hey, this NPC is, you know, dynamically generating text or audio or what have you, right? Like the right. All those pieces kind of have to work together, in my view, to be served up in this like sort of high, you know, really smart customized way.
Right.
Like we can unlock a scale there of like depth of customization we never could do before. That is way different than what we've ever seen. I think it's gonna take time, kind of more on a like design level, like how do we best use that in ways that are really compelling, but.
Building something that doesn't break it, right? Yeah, like
absolutely, break the absolutely. Game. I mean, it's not tomorrow. It's not like, you know, it's going to be fits and starts, right? I think that's going to be pretty wild. So those are like some specifics, right? Like the easy version of that, which has already existed for years, like, you know, personalized stuff in the shop. But what if you personalize? Right. What if you personalize it in the shop, but then you see that thing in the next game you play, and you get to, you know, like you're able to pick it up, and so, you know, that stuff is really, really, really powerful. And there's tons of greenfield room there that games are just starting to execute on to a greater degree, or using AI opponents in a smarter way. You asked about content generation costs going down. I actually don't think long term that's going to happen. I think. That will almost immediately, I think in the short term, yeah, like for some people that choose to use generative AI, like art assets, which is not something we're like doing right now. For people that do that, there's some short-term cost savings, but I think they'll just get gobbled up with the expectation of making more content, right? Like they'll just cause the cost to come up in some other ways. That like long term, I don't think it's a sustainable cost cutting advantage. And then there's a ton of stuff that's a little more tech focused on the developer side. We call it like giving our developers mech suits. So like engineers being able to code, you know, just simple things like lots of people, you know, using GitHub Copilot, things like that. Having more automated like code review, test generation, making documentation in a dynamic way. Designers that are able to do like balance testing with like millions of games with reinforcement learning.
Right.
Right. Being able to interact with like big data sets and not have to know like SQL or be a data engineer, but just like be able to use like natural language to ask a question and get an answer back right away. That stuff is not like sexy by itself, right? Like each one of those things. But when you add those things up, I think it's a real, and obviously lots of people are saying this, it's a real possibility that we're, you know, 5x-ing, 10x-ing developers' effectiveness, like in pretty short order, right? And we're very much believers in this. So we've been pressing really hard here and gotten a lot of yield already.
Right. All right. I'll capitulate to the mech suit kind of idea. I think that's kind of a cool way of saying it. I just think a lot of people's expectations and buzzword salad from A16Z and frickin' McKenzie, you know, are making it sound like this is the second coming. And again, as I said in the podcast, I believe that the AI is an absolutely massive thing for the world in general, and it's going to have a broad impact. I just don't know how much impact it's going to have on gaming specifically. So
name a technology that you've interacted with that has evolved as fast as AI has evolved in the last 18 months.
Yeah, I agree, but facilitating game design is a different story than...
Of course, I'm just most arguments, right? I think most arguments about that future boil down to this, right? It's this technology is advancing and improving at such a it's such a rate that of course some of the things they're saying are wrong. Of course, like it's not going to work exactly how people like we get really hung up on that. But like the dumb version of this to me that makes sense. I'm definitely not an engineer. Is wow, like any technology that advances that rapidly for a long enough period of time, like with obvious use cases, right? Without like, you know, it's not just some like thing that's like just it's almost certainly going to be dramatically disruptive to every aspect of making software, right? Like that's
right. And the unpredictability of it is meaning people like me should not be speculating.
Of course. Anyone, that's why I said you can I don't know how you could be kind of on the other side of this unless you felt like, hey, that progress is going to like stop, right? That kind of like rapid advancement. If maybe that's, I don't know. Again, I'm not an AI engineer. Like maybe someday we run out of LLM advancement and, you know, GPT-5 is like not good enough or whatever but man, this is like breakneck right now, right?
You're older
than me. Do you remember like when the telephone was invented, Eric? I don't know like how fast that went. No, I'm just kidding, but
that was rude.
It's like a huge advancement.
We shall see. I don't want to open up this can of worms too much, but I know your company is fully remote, right?
We are fully remote. We have an office, a physical office in Southern California, but we don't require anyone to be there.
Do you go to the office yourself?
I do not live in Southern California anymore. I'm there about every 2 months for a week.
Wow. So how many actually people work in the office?
Average day, 3 to 5.
Oh my, okay. So you're fully remote.
I'm fully remote. We're fully remote.
All right. I've stayed out of this mess because I've been actually fully remote for the last 10 years since I started Gossamer. So I don't work at big companies anymore. So I want to stay out of the fray on something but sometimes I think that like, I think the remote work has caused a lot of issues with people and it probably made me a little bit more antisocial than I otherwise would be. Not that I wouldn't have been all antisocial before. So anyway, how do you feel like remote's working for you guys? Is there any plans of going, you know, Google and Facebook and Amazon and everyone else trying to get people back in the office? Like, is there, what are you thinking about it these days?
First of all, no plans to go back. It's worked well for us, but it's not always easy. And it's definitely not for everyone. You wouldn't find any of us saying like, all companies should always be remote. There's some really great things about it. You know, fundamentally, I think our model really depends on us attracting and retaining like the very best talent and really aggressively trying to get those people. And there's a lot of people for us that kind of working remotely, it really resonated with them, especially people that maybe had a role that was going to require them to go back to an office, et cetera. People have lots of reasons for wanting remote, personal reasons, family reasons, medical reasons, you know, lots of things. I personally moved for kind of family related reasons. It's a really big advantage for those people, and kind of attracting and retaining them. That's huge. It's been great for me personally, selfishly. It gives people some, you know, additional time savings, like, you know, the classic like commuting to the office, all that stuff. It also reduces our cost and complexity like around scaling and some of our flexibility there. Like we don't need to, you know, worry about the administrative burden, like a new office space or rent or, you know, kind of like huge rent or some of those things that's, you know, those are good. Those are good, valuable pieces. There's really challenging parts too. I think the biggest challenge, honestly, is we generally, you know, we all do our best work when we're in a high trust environment, and it's harder to build that kind of deep trust and character and competence remotely. It's just harder to do that. It's harder to onboard like inexperienced people that might need more kind of like that kind of more informal guidance and direction. It's definitely harder. It's also harder for new managers who are kind of inexperienced in managing, who might need to like learn more like soft skill stuff and like making sure they're getting the tools they need. I also think if I were, you know, you mentioned some, you know, the FANG kind of companies, I've heard from a lot of people that, and I believe it's much harder to run like a, and get like total buy-in from like super huge, you know, 10,000 plus people, companies and huge teams, like getting them, like everyone like bought in and fully committed and those things. I think that would be super hard. I don't think we'll be 10,000 people anytime soon, but maybe we'll need to revisit when we cross that threshold. And it's a bunch of like new skills to learn. And I think it helped us a lot that we kind of made the commitment, because none of us had done any remote basically till COVID. And then we made that commitment to stay remote like within the year. We do a bunch of things to address some of that. We do in-person summits like twice a year in SoCal. They're mostly focused on just like relationship building, right? Getting people together, trying to build a lot of those bonds, especially between people that aren't working together every day, because there's like just you get less of that. We set pretty like, you know, stringent expectations around like core hours. We're camera on for everything. We give, this is a very dumb one, but I always tell people, we give a lot of feedback on people's AV setups. So like, and we make sure they have like good camera and lighting and microphone. It's like really shocking to us that people have been, we'll talk to people at other companies and they'll have like a messed up audio thing. And they'll be like, it's been like that for years, I guess. And like, no one ever told them that. That's like small, but I think important. And then we do a lot of, we're pretty receptive for smaller teams or groups or pods that want to like fly in for like a multi-day meetup in SoCal to work together. You know, we try to enable that where we can and where it makes sense. And we do still have that small office that's like our, you know, home office, like hub for company summits, that sort of thing. And for people that minority people that do prefer that like physical office kind of environment. Not for everybody though. I'm definitely not like rah-rah, everyone should do it. It's not easy. I think it helped us a lot that our founding, you know, our executive team, we've been all working together for more than a decade. And if, you know, we just had a ton of built up trust and sort of strength of relationship. I think if we were like starting a new company with someone I didn't know or someone I just met, it'd be way harder versus like expanding kind of the trust web, you know, if you will, like, hey, we have a really tight nucleus of people that started the company that are high trust and we can like extend that outward is a lot easier than like from day one, we got to build all that up.
Honestly, though, it seems to me that like, at your scale, it kind of makes sense. But if you really want to scale the company into a $4 billion company, like fully remote is likely not going to work ultimately. But I guess for now.
I think, you know, we have a lot of plans. I think one thing that helps a lot is giving teams like a lot of making teams working on projects feel really cohesive. So even if you're like relatively big within your team of, you know, if you're, you know, in prototype phase, like a couple people, right, all the way up to live operating with 100 people, 100 plus, that's totally different than like, hey, we like, you know, that's really the like the scale, right, that you're building that around versus building it like for the whole company kind of as one big unit.
Got it. All right. All right, let's finish this off with an easy one. What are you playing and what are you looking forward to this year from a game perspective?
Right. I'm I was recently at COVID for the first time. And so I played isolated and I played an absurd amount of Dave the Diver on my Steam Deck. It was just super, super fun. I made a lot of sushi. That game's really fun. Playing a lot of Snap, obviously. It's a bunch of mobile games I play on and off, like Monopoly Go. We talked about the Royal Match, Death Must Die was in early access still, I think, on Steam. I'm like a crazy Vampire Survivors fan. Played some Survivor IO, but I still love OG Vampire Survivors. I got like hundreds of hours on that game. Triangle Strategy, which is like that I also play on Steam Deck, which is like kind of like in the Disgaea, like Final Fantasy Tactics kind of game, this like 2.5D like Octopath style visuals, which I really, really like. Someday someone's gonna make, maybe it'll be me, but I think it's a hard problem, but someone's gonna make the amazing like that game mobile free to play live ops. And there's been a few out there. There's a Fire Emblem game and stuff, and still waiting for someone to make like the version of that really scratches some itch for me. AAA, playing a little bit less now, but like Spider-Man 2 not that long ago. Was playing a bunch of Diablo 4, and now I'm kind of resting, waiting for the expansion. What else? I play a lot of like, I cycled through like a lot of like word games, like, you know, all the like the new, like the Wordles, that kind of stuff. Big Duolingo guy.
For Christ's sake. Really?
Dude, yes. I love, they have a lot of, they have a very smart product team. I really, I think that happens to be strong. And then there's like a bunch of, there's a few games that are more like for work research stuff that I'm trying. So that's like last couple months have been what I've been playing.
And what's coming up that you're excited about?
It feels like, don't you feel like this year's a little thinner?
Yeah, it's freaking thin. Paper.
Yeah.
Wispy.
Like we're all waiting for like console refresh, you know, like I'm like on Nintendo.
Or GTA, like a GTA release.
Yeah, I mean, GTA is gonna be amazing. I'm so excited. So D4 expansion for sure. I think Hades 2 is gonna be out, at least early access this year.
Yeah, you're right.
Hades is I like love that game and like every aspect of that game. Amazing VO. I want to play the Final Fantasy VII remake, both. I haven't played the first one. I think I'm going to play them both when they come out, when the next one comes out on PS5. I haven't played Power World yet. I don't know if you've...
I can't believe it. Actually, I'm a little bit surprised.
I'm a little bit surprised too. I just, I had COVID and that kind of was traveling. So hopefully next week, I'm going to see if I can run it. Actually, I need to look today to make sure I can run it on my laptop. So when I go to Dice and back in my introversion hotel room, I can play.
I don't think it's a system hog at all, so I think you'd be all right.
I think I'm gonna be okay. I still haven't played Elden Ring and I really want to, even though it's like not exactly my jam, maybe, but
that's too hard. Yeah,
I think I should. You just want to grind and then just steamroll everything. That's what you want to just like,
yeah, basically
that's like it. What you want to do, you just want to like, you'll just sit there. Yeah. I haven't gotten a mess with I haven't gotten one yet. The Vision Pro, the Apple Vision Pro. Not because I think it's like going to be a huge scale. I generally agree. I think it's going to be, it's a ways away. But I am like, I got a soft spot for that stuff. One of my first projects I ever worked on in games was a game jam with the original Oculus SDK, like 12 years ago or something, 13 years,
yeah, yeah.
13 years ago. I think it's ways to go before commercial scalability, but it's cool. It is cool. You know, just because something's not scalable yet doesn't mean it's not cool. So
I agree. I think it is pretty cool tech, pretty cool kit, but I don't know what the future is for that. All right, man. Well,
better input schema. That's what I'm just like waiting for better. I'm excited to just try that out because that's like,
I think, I think Minority Report ruined it because I think there's just no way we'll ever see it. Maybe eventually.
AI something.
Yeah. All right, Mr. Weibel, it was good chatting. I'm glad we got to do this. We will do it again as you go on your mad PR, campaign. Anyway, if anybody needs to,
PR agency, Eric, you gotta tell me what I need to book.
What's the best way to reach out to you?
LinkedIn. I'm on the DOF Slack. If for folks that are in that, you can hit me up there.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you for listening to the whole episode. If you like this podcast, please do leave a comment and share the episode. If you want to access the Deconstructor of Fun community with hundreds of senior games folk, go to our website and apply to the Slack group. And if you want to get notified of all the new content we have coming out every week, do subscribe to the weekly Deconstructor of Fun newsletter. Finally, do remember, we love you guys and we appreciate you guys. Catch you next time.